My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines, and we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
Wrestling Omakase is back, baby. The weekly podcast that takes you across all the top promotions on the entire Japanese wrestling scene. From New Japan to Stardom, NOAH, DDT, All Japan, Marie Gold, Dragon Gate, Tokyo Joshi, Sendai Girls, and a whole lot more. I'm John Carroll, a fan of Japanese wrestling for over 20 years, and every week I'm joined by a rotating cast of guest co-hosts as we break down all the top promotions in Japan, men's and women's. Check out Wrestling Omakase right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network today.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day. Gotta let it go. So far, rain is a call. Fast to freedom. Down. Stars tonight.
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate for September 8th, 2025. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on social media at Open Voice Gate. And if you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red box that says Sponsors Podcasting, set up a one-time or reoccurring donation, no obligation whatsoever, but I would like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts, it's your old pal Mike Spears, joined alongside your other host Case Lowe. In case I was telling you right before we hit record, I am finally feeling like my house is feeling lived in, only because the one place that I have really like unpacked and have had an outside presence on what goes on walls is in the office, and I am right now looking at the February 22nd, 1994 weekly pro wrestling. It just makes me happy, and I got a bunch of Shoe Pro in the mail, and that's always kind of a fun thing to go through. I think I got all of them through. I'm not going to deal with any of the custom stuff, but how have you been, bud?
Fantastic. Very happy to be here. Big episode. I don't have anything particularly thrilling to talk about. I have no fun updates, but also no bad updates. I'm here, hey. And you know, I'm very very excited to be here and talk Dragon Gate with you. I have nothing. Yeah. Normally I have you threw it to me because you're a broadcasting professional, and normally I'd have something witty to say. I'd mention some band nobody cares about. I talk about tennis because I'm all on the tennis now. I might leave you and start Open the Tennis Gate with Alan Forel because I've gotten really into tennis over the last month.
Hey, that was in my quad box yesterday. I get it.
I have somebody in my life who's really into tennis, and so I started watching it. I was like, turns out tennis is awesome. Don't know why I hadn't been watching it sooner.
Is tennis like on this upswing? Because I feel like at least this U.S. Open, there was more of the celebrities being seen at the U.S. Open than in past years. And I know that it's always been like fashionable, especially for like the European or like world celebrities to show up at Wimbledon, French Open and stuff like that. But I never really felt like it happened for the US Open until like I see all these photos of Christine Baranski at the US Open case. And I would go like, I guess the US Open and tennis is now big again.
I don't know, because it kind of goes into the talking point that we always have on the show about fame and monoculture and things like that. Sure. Where like, you know, Sinner and Alcaraz are just never going to be as famous as Federer and Nadal were. So it's hard to make a direct comparison point, because just objectively the biggest tennis stars are not as famous as they used to be. But I don't know. I enjoy the game. Once I finally figured out, it took me 26 years to understand the scoring of tennis, and once I got that, I was all in. So it was a very enjoyable US Open, although I do consider myself to be a Sinner fan, and I was disappointed by the result yesterday.
Now that you know tennis scoring, I need to propose to you cricket, because we can start talking about
that. Yeah. I'm not doing that. Look, we don't have time to record Michinoku Pro podcast right now. I can't get into cricket. That's going to be a bad look for me.
The World Cup's coming up soon, man. I mean, come on.
The World Cup of cricket?
Oh, yeah. World Cricket Cup.
I'm not watching that.
The U.S. might actually qualify.
Good.
This is for 2027.
I'm very happy for the American-born professional cricket players. I'll never learn their names.
Fair enough.
I'm good. I do see the clips of the cricket video game every once in a while, and I go, that looks like a good time. But then I think, there's so many other things to do on Earth, and our time is limited, and I don't know if cricket video game is the best use of my time.
Actually, I have the perfect one cricket thing that if you are bored and in a wiki hole, who you should look up and just read his article, and that's it. Don Bradman. Write it down.
Don Bradman.
He used to be, even though he's been dead for like a while, he used to be the Madden of cricket games, even though like his heyday was the 30s. But Don Bradman, he is, I'm convinced, the most dominating athlete in a team sport ever. Like it'll be a good 30-minute Wikipedia wiki hole for you.
Interesting. All right, Don Bradman. I'll look it up after we're done here.
Yeah. And you'll be like, oh wow, how a sport actually changed because one person was way too good at it.
You know, the point I like to make, not to get too sidetracked here, but I do consider Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to be the greatest basketball player of all time, and he's often omitted from the what should be the Michael Jordan LeBron discussion, which has somehow, and it pains me, and even though I love TJ Perkins as a pro wrestler, it has somehow turned into the Jordan LeBron Kobe discussion, even though I'm not sure Kobe's one of the 10 greatest players of all time. But I do always like to point out that they had to change the rules multiple times because Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was so good at basketball that in both his high school, or I guess not both, but in his high school, collegiate, and professional career, they had to change the rules. So I always like to mention that.
Yeah, no, Don Bradman and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar have a lot in common in that regard. Don't
Did
know
Don
much
Bradman
else.
Also write a Veronica Mars script?
No. And is not a great cultural theorist of our times. Maybe the closest thing that we have to like a modern Gore Vidal. No.
Yes.
No.
That's too bad.
He was not like that. He cared about the cricket and nothing else.
All right. Well, I respect a hustler. So there you go. I will look into that.
But that's not what all we're hearing in case was desperately trying to get through so we could talk about the big stuff. We've been teasing it. As soon as Madoka Kakuta made everyone throw down their Zebrats colors, we're going to lead off tonight talking about Zebrats as not like a full retrospective kind of episode, but now that they are done and dusted and now we have Gaja Dokuro as the new heel unit, we're going to take some time to talk about that. And speaking of Gaja Dokuro, their first big night happening on Thursday in Cork, and the big Stormgate show with two title matches. We'll review that on the show, then talk about this weekend's show coming up in Sendai. But Case, now we could actually finally put the chiseling on the tombstone of Zebrats. I think it's the right time, and we kind of got like 3 weeks of like an antebellum between the two heel units kind of period that we got before Gaja Dokuro. But it kind of, as I was getting together my notes today about Zebrats, it's kind of remarkable when you like sit down and take stock of it, like what kind of heel unit this was, especially coming off of a very hard to overstate RED unit that was kind of the era dominant unit for its time. It's very hard for the Dragon System to kind of carry one killer heal unit into another. Usually you end up with an Anti-Os before you go into that direction. But you have RED followed up by Zebrats, two era-defining heal units back-to-back, and one of the, I feel like, the best back-to-back stretches of heal units in Dragon System history. And I think as I was putting together the notes of Zebrats, it had every single member on this, and I feel like that's like one of the big differences about Zebrats versus RED. Zebrats got big, but you did not have any wastes of space around in that unit throughout its whole entire time. I didn't mean to get off on a tangent immediately, Case, but let's talk about Zebrats to lead off tonight.
I think they're such an interesting unit historically because I'm with you. I think they're one of the greatest heal units this company has ever seen. I think they're one of the better units this company has ever seen, and that doesn't mean that there weren't lulls during their history. I always go back to that time when Diamante was hurt, Hulk was hurt, Kento was in North America, and they were running trios matches on every show with Hyo, Kai, and Shun, and they never felt particularly exciting. But outside of, you know, essentially the spring and maybe early summer of 2022, this is a unit that provided unforgettable matches, really iconic moments, and I think elevated the careers of so many different wrestlers. I think Hyo is in a better position in his career because of Zebrats. I think Diamante, there's a complicated legacy there, but I think Diamante is in a better position in his career because of Zebrats. I think Jason Lee unquestionably is in a better position in his career because of Zebrats. I think the same for Coach Menor. I think, you know, Zebrats provided a really nice life preserver for him during his time in that unit. And then you have Gianni Valletta doing the work that he did in Zebrats, which I think is really memorable and kind of something that I'll always think about when I think of this unit. And then, of course, you have Shun Skywalker. And I guess I'll start here with you. The first question I want to throw your way is, in the history of this promotion, if you want to go back to even Toriumon, I think I want to include them in this question. Is there a wrestler that singularly defined his unit more than Shun Skywalker and Zebrats?
I think when you talk about like the heel units, it really ends up being a discussion about not necessarily who's the one, but who are the name players that are the ones that you expect to see in the main events. And really, outside of Shingo's Berserk, I would argue that a heel unit hasn't been as formed and like a single monster as Shun Skywalker Zebrats was. I feel like that he, in a lot of ways, especially as it relates to the heel unit kind of family line, and I feel like he was able to take a unit that by the time of RED's dissolvement and rolling into Zebrats was at a point where it was time, and that you had some instances of people throughout the unit that you're like, oh yeah, no, makes total sense. Yasushi Kanda started in this unit and threw down his colors near immediately. That definitely was something that needed to happen, but you don't have that necessarily in Zebrats as much. You had really just this one solid core that got you basically right to the finish line with Kakuta coming in, and then basically, I mean, we could call it for what it is now, like usurped the heel unit's power and decides to cast it aside to form his new unit. And you don't necessarily have that RED, even though Eito was a leader. We've talked at length about how it was Pac's Dreamgate run as the thing that provided the foundation for the later parts of that unit to really be successful. And if you keep on just going back from that, Anti-Os, there was no real clear leader, and it was the whole specter of Takagi around three not over young guys. And then going backwards to the Berserk, then, you know, it started off as like this three-headed dragon of Takagi and Doyama before they cut out Doi and Yamato down the line. And as you're like going down this list, like before you know it, we're back to Matt Blanky, where you had two different distinct eras of leadership there. And when you start talking about like Matt Blanky, Berserk, and RED, as like your lineage as it exists, and the fact that this one, more so than Matt Blanky, who had two leaders, more so than Berserk, who started as a three-headed monster, more so than Antios that never figured itself out, and more so than RED, who was figured out not by their founder, Zebrats kind of stands by itself, at least in my mind, at least when you're looking at like heel unit coherency as it relates to solid just leadership. Because I mean, really, you have someone that Kai, yes, was like has been like listed as the nominal leader, but essentially he comes in to the dying days of RED. They eject the parts of RED that made it RED. He forms Zebrats, and then basically up until Kobe World, you have one unified leadership by one person. And I think that it's hard, other than maybe just because of how long it has existed. If you look at the face side with Natural Vibes and KZ as that kind of singular leader, but then you have the conversation about, oh, he gave up leadership. Is this unit still about him? So I think at the end of the conversation, at least the way I'm kind of having it in my mind case, it has to be Shun as the most powerful kind of singular leader of a unit in recent era. I mean, at least dating back to the days of Matt Blanky.
Definitely in the recent era, I would agree with that. Because I would even say, I think when Berserk was at their best, you know, it was Takagi, Yamato, and Doi on an even playing field. So
yeah,
the
three-headed monster there, yeah.
So I can't even say Berserk in that context. I mean, I really think this unit is defined by Shun Skywalker in the same way that Crazy Max was defined by Shima, or the Italian Connection was defined by Milano Collection AT. And I'm not sure that we've seen a unit in Dragon Gate, you know, not World 1, not Blood Generation, because I found Blood Generation strength to be strength in numbers, you know, not Junction 3, not Blood Warriors. I'm not sure we've had a unit actually that started in Dragon Gate proper that has been so dominant and so defined by one singular wrestler. And that, to me, coming away from Zebrats, you know, now with Skywalker, you know, removed from the heel unit for over a month now, that is what I'm taking away from it, is that no matter who the Dreamgate champion was, no matter what was going on in that unit, it was a vehicle for Shun Skywalker more than it was a vehicle for the entire unit. And I think that was greatly beneficial to Dreamgate as a whole.
So two things I really want to talk about, beneficial to Shun versus beneficial to the unit. I want to go through the, I have a little game to play with you as we talk through this, but you brought up Blood Generation, and I feel like later when we start talking about Gacha Dokuro, keep Blood Generation in your head, because I have a talking point in my notes straight up about Gacha Dokuro and kind of how it kind of has that more of an impression. And I feel like that when you have like a leader like that is so strong, you end up with a successor unit that kind of wipes the slate clean in the way like that Gacha Dokuro does, case. But you said that no matter Shun Skywalker strength to the unit really was a thing that kind of boosted it. There were 14 members of Zebrats, and I have them all pulled up right here, case. And I don't think there are very many units throughout Dragon System history, especially heel units, where you have to do a lot of things with heel units. You have to have your top line Shun Skywalker figures, but you got to have your Ditch Diggers. You have to have your Mondai Ryus, your Yos, and people like that. I'm going to run down the list of 14 Ks, and I want you to say, are they better when they came out of Zebrats than they were going into it? Okay?
Sounds good.
All right, Shun Skywalker.
Very much so better.
Kai.
I think Kai's career peaked in RED, and I found him to take a slight step down in Zebrats, especially as that unit continued. I think the best work of his career was done in RED.
That's fair. Kai was the one person that when I put this together, I thought we might be able to do that. Maybe RED to Zebrats was more of a gradual decline than a stiff drop that could have happened.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Hyo.
Hyo's in a better spot because of Zebrats. You know, I think he fully carved out his niche in Zebrats, and you know, that coincided with the first Brave Gate run. Is that right? Did he win the Brave Gate belt in Zebrats? I'm now forgetting when he
had one in RED, and then he had one in Zebrats because it was the lead up to Kento's farewell match.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah. No, he's got the one from December of 2022 to July of 2022. No, he won it at World. Okay, yeah, that's what I mean, though. He had that Bravegate reign during his time in Z-Brass, and I think that greatly benefited his career.
BB Hulk.
I would not say Z-Brats helped his career, no.
I think that he goes from Z-Brats into being a major figure in the continued revitalization of Gold Class before that. I think Hulk comes out of it a little stronger because of where he goes afterwards with that face.
Possibly. I mean, post-prime BB Hulk is a little hard to dissect because there's so many other times in his career where he's felt more vital, and Z-Brats, that run was very short and very futile, but it did transition him into Gold Class. And all the warts and all, I still really enjoyed the original incarnation of Gold Class.
Now, talking about futility, SB Kento, we could both agree a lot worse off.
Yeah, because his career peaked in RED. You know, that's a guy who he was only around for the first 6 months of Z-Brats, and the most memorable stuff that he did was long before the transition to the black and yellow.
And it felt like when he was leaving, it would have been, okay, he's going to return from excursion with the big baby face push, but things don't end up that way. Diamante, I'd argue that, I mean, at least after unmasking until Big Hug ended up being what Big Hug was, he came out of the unit looking a lot better. I mean, now in 2025, we have questions about how that all was handled, but at least initially, I think he ended up better off. But I think that the tail time afterwards and how it was handled afterwards has been the big thing that has really put the question mark on his post Z-Brats tenure.
I think Z-Brats was beneficial to his career. I also just think his run in Z-Brats, the 18 months that he was there, if you put that in a 90-second mixtape and labeled it Diamante, was a problem. I think people that have never seen him before would sit back and go, oh, is this the greatest wrestler of all time? You know, why haven't I heard of this guy? Because his output during his time specifically in Z-Brats was unbelievable. And while I think there was booking malpractice in his Dreamgate run, it is Z-Brats that ultimately got him into that position. So I think Z-Brats was incredibly beneficial for him.
Yeah, and then we're going to get through the ones that I think we are going to be very quick yeses. Ishin.
Yes.
Yoshiki Kato.
Yes.
Johnny Valletta.
Yes.
Deimos, technically?
Oh, I would not say yes to him, but good poll. I would not. If this was a 5-star match game, I never would have gotten that.
Yeah, you have to get all 14 of them for that. Kota Minoura.
Yeah, you know, I think Z-Brats has provided a very nice lifeline for his career. And my point when he initially turned and we started talking about, you know, what happens if Shun Skywalker turns babyface, then, you know, I was very much afraid of them essentially doing what they've done with Skywalker and Kakuta, but with Skywalker and Minoura. And I knew Minoura wasn't going to be strong enough to lead that charge. Instead, we have this weird situation with Minoura where he has essentially taken a step back in his career, and I think it's made him better off. I think he's in a better standing now in the company, slotted firmly as Jason Lee's tag team partner, and I think that's a very important role to have, and I think it's a role that he's very comfortable in, and I think it's a role that he's very good in. And for that, it seems like maybe, and knock on wood, this could drastically change, but maybe we kind of know who Coach Minoura is now, and that's because of Z-Brats.
Yeah, I feel like that kind of, not to necessarily parrot off of you, Gold Class Kota Minoura, if you're going to do a range of what his performance could be in any night, you're talking the entire 0 to 10. Like, it could equally land anywhere from there, but, like, you're just as likely to get the good lead-up and winning the King of Gate win to the Minoura debacle. You just, that's what you get with the guy. I think the heel turn and the de-emphasize, maybe he can't hit 10 anymore, and 9's a little bit more tough, but you're not seeing any of the 0s, 1s, or 2s anymore. It's a more consistent band performance that I feel like for a guy who, I think that, like, some of this is booking malpractice, and some of it is you're doing a square block in a round hole with him. And I think he's more realistic in the Jason Lee tag team partner and filling out like the main event tag team roles. Like, that's great for him. And if there is a time you want to have him have a Dreamgate shot, he has the credibility to do that. He can take a Dream Key and eat a Fallen, and it's not going to really hurt his progression, because we've seen what happened with hurting his progression much earlier on.
Unless I'm forgetting something, I don't feel like we've had any sort of Zebrats era Coach Minora crash outs on this podcast. It's been pretty self-contained. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's just been very good. 11
piece crash outs.
Yeah, no, he's just been very good in Zebrats. And, you know, I found that the one time that he was maybe a little bit exposed, for lack of a better term, in this unit was when we were in Vegas and you saw the babyface crew and Skywalker and Ishin really embrace that environment. And Minora was Coach Minora. And that wasn't actively bad, but it also wasn't actively good. I mean, that feels like his biggest blemish in Zebrats. But largely, he's been contained to a tag team, and that tag team has mostly been very, very good.
Himari.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And then Jason Lee, yes. And Madoka Kakuta, yes, as we're seeing right now.
I mean, the Jason stuff is crazy because I never expected this to be his heel output. I don't know if I ever, you know, it reminds me very much, and this might sound like a drastic comparison to some, but it reminds me of Pac's heel turn, where I would have never bought into it being this good, because they were so good at being the one specific lawful good type character. And that, just being such a fan of both of those wrestlers, it satisfied whatever desire I had for years and years and years. And I wasn't anticipating any change, nor did I necessarily want any change. But for Jason to turn, for it to be an effective turn that led to the brilliant cage match last year, and then for him to just continue doing the work that he's done as a heel, is something that I never would have expected. And I'm continuously blown away by how good he's been in this role.
Yeah, no, I mean, as much as the two of us, we go like, yeah, no, Jason should have a Dreamgate shot, and as natural vibes, Jason. Now we have seen, like, through Zebrats and how he's like positioned himself to, it's like, no, not only could he be a Dreamgate shot, but he's actually probably a better heel wrestler than he ever was as a babyface. Very similar to Pac in that regard. And those are the 14 members of Zebrats. The only three that we can really have any sort of debate about is someone or two people in their deep depths of their career, like closing it out, and SP Kento, which I think everyone would agree that that's a step down from that. So I don't think you could say that about RED case. I'm certain we can't say that about Berserk. But I'd argue that Zebrats has done the best of taking its members and throughout the tenure of the unit. And as we've now kind of seen some of them, of course, much earlier shift out of the unit, but now fully out of Zebrats, I'd argue that maybe no heel unit has left Dragon Gate a better place for it, more so than maybe Matt Blanky back in the day. Like, that's the kind of thing that I feel like that this unit did, was it really, for a lot of these younger guys on the roster where they're trying to figure it out so much, or for people that just get the reps, as we saw with like someone like Diamante, I think it's unquestioned that Zebrats ends up being one of the most successful units in Dragon System history.
I'm struggling to figure out the historical comparison that I want to make, because I find this unit to be very different than Berserk at its best, and I find this unit really to be even way different than Mad Blanky at their best. I really do think it might be the closest thing we've seen to a Blood Generation, because a lot of these guys are going to be defined by the work that they did in this unit. You know, the peak of Diamante's career is going to be Diamante era Zebrats. Again, you make a 90-second mixtape there, you're going to think he's the best wrestler in the world. Shun Skywalker, we'll see. You know, if his career ends up not being defined by Zebrats, then I think we're talking about somebody who is going to enter a very, very special territory historically. Ishin, I think we're all hoping that his career is not defined by Zebrats, that he's able to take a step up, but his career will not be a failure if we look back on 2022 to 2025 and go, wow, look at the stretch of matches that he had there. And, you know, and then again, the Valletta stuff, which has just brought me so much joy over the years. I've just loved what they've done with Gianni Valletta and Zebrats. And I pat myself on the back for seeing the potential there pretty quickly on that one. it's a very special unit, and I think this next heel unit has a lot of pressure on them to completely redefine themselves. You know, you talked about that a little bit at the beginning of it was a seamless transition from RED to Zebrats, again, largely led by Kai. The energy that Kakuta brings is polar opposite to the energy that Skywalker brings. And I think it's going to be jarring for a little bit. You know, we'll see. Maybe they hit the ground running and just having the through line of Ishin and having the through line of Kato and Jason and Minora. Maybe that makes this transition easier. We don't notice a difference. We all move on with our life and the heel unit continues to do great work. But I think there is a chance, not even for a stumble, not even for a hiccup, but just for a noticeable difference with Kakuta at the helm and this unit taking on a different name, different logos, slightly different colors, a different attitude. And I'm very curious to see how that goes, because I still like the core of this unit so much, but it is something different. And 3.5 years led by Shun Skywalker is a large amount of time in this promotion's history and a very memorable amount of time in this promotion's history.
Yeah, I feel like I know it's some of the more recent kind of transitional history, like heel unit wise, you need the just drastic change that you saw from Mad Blanky at the end of 2013 or at the end of 2015 was downright beloved as the heel unit that had been around so long, and you had all the members into it, and it became kind of, it ended up being what happens when a heel unit lasts too long. We saw that through Crazy Max. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Some of the units, and you're able to capitalize it and be like, okay, Crazy Max goes kind of tweener now because we have M2K and then Italian Connection and T2P shows up. They can go back being heel over there. But you saw such a huge difference from Mad Blanky into the Interregnum that led immediately into Berserk. And a lot of that was Shingo's personality and it being a heel unit in Shingo's image. And I feel like we need to, that we have started to see a little bit of that with Gacha Dokuro, and how that at the very least, like, there's no like joking around whatsoever with this unit. Ishin's like comedy chops mainly go to, oh my God, that's the most mist I've seen anyone spray on themselves while doing a missing attack. And I feel like just even like the imagery and going now to going from something that could only be described as whatever is coming out of Shun Skywalker's mind at any one point to now something that at least feels more focused. I think that's kind of the transition we want to see. And hopefully as Gacha Dokuro goes along, and especially looking at some of the stuff coming up for Gacha Dokuro, I really want to kind of see that change continue, wouldn't you say?
Very much so. No, I think that's well said.
Any other big Zebrats things you wanted to touch on as we're kind of giving its eulogy right here?
I've got one more point to make that I was thinking about earlier today, and it goes to this long-standing conversation that I have with myself about the booking of this promotion over the last 4 or 5 years, where, you know, again, I really enjoy this promotion, especially, you know, I thought 2024 was largely phenomenal. I think this year has been great, maybe a slight step down from 2024. But I go back to the thought that maybe this promotion is just slightly too conservative in their booking, and at a time where they continue, and this Cork and Hall show, no different, they just continue to struggle to gain any traction at the box office. I wonder if at times they are leaving big matches on the table. And I do feel like if I had to do Zebrats again, I would have wanted a much longer run with Shun Skywalker and Diamante as a tag team. Now, you can make the point that Diamante was injured for a little bit of time, and that, you know, that might have taken away from some of their 2-on-2 matches. But you think about what Skywalker and Diamante did from, you know, essentially the two big matches we have of theirs versus D-Courage at Dead or Alive 2022, and then one of the great matches of all time against Kame and Jason Lee at the Ultimate Dragon 35th Anniversary Show. And the fact that they have those two matches and really nothing else to their name feels like a massive misfire to me. When you factor in Skywalker being a main event talent at that point, the look of that tag team and the output of that tag team, I feel like we might have missed the boat there with not having them have just more high profile matches and having them have a longer run as Twin Gate champions.
Yeah, and especially, I guess, some of that is we kind of saw what would happen with after the face turn for Diamante, and he just has never really has found that partner that he had at that time. I mean, even like the company even kind of plays on that a little bit with SSW Quest, with the fact that Shun was like, oh yeah, no, you're going to be Masses Diamante, and that's how we're going to do this, is that there is this feeling of an opportunity lost there. And I feel like that there are like certain pairings within Z-Brats I would have liked to see either more of, or just just history would go down in different ways, such as like it is wild that we're talking about the end of Z-Brats and SB Kento is such a little bit of a factor here that I'm going, oh yeah, I would have liked to see a little bit more of SB Kento and Hio as Bamashiri brothers tag team. I will, maybe that in a Rey de Parejas format ends up being a really fun tag team to come out of there with it, because we never really got to see that highlight run with them. And then towards the end of it, the booking wasn't going to allow it to get more of a run, but the Triangle Gate team of Ishin, Hamare, and Yoshiki Kato was a lot of fun, and I feel like there could have been a lot more with that run. But now it was very clear why they got the belts off of Hamare, got him face turned, and now he is back in the equation on the other side. But those are kind of the two other teams I feel like we lost a little bit, that we did not get to see as much in Z-Brats that I would have liked to see.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would have liked to have seen Diamante under the mask versus Takuma Fujiwara more than we did. You know, all told, Z-Brats, I mean, that first 6 months, you just think about the chaos of 2022 between the kids going on excursion, the Coach Minoru stuff, the volatility of Kai as Dreamgate champion, even if I think looking back on it, that was a very solid run, you know, middle of the tier Dreamgate run, middle tier Dreamgate run, I should say. It was just marred in chaos for the first 6 months. And the fact that they were able to get out of that, define themselves as who they were, you know, we got to see as this unit went on, no matter who was underneath Skywalker, there was sort of a, I guess I want to make this point, because I saw in the Discord this week that we found the footage of Skywalker, Ishin, and Minoru on the New Texas Pro show, or not New Texas Pro. What was the indie that you and I went and saw with all the Izzy fans?
Yeah. It was the Corpus Christi indie. It was Texas Wrestling Cartel.
Texas Wrestling Cartel. That's what it was. Sorry, Biss. New Texas Wrestling is you. But the Texas Wrestling Cartel show, it was just so funny to me watching Skywalker, Ishin, and Minoru in that environment, because that was when it really dawned on me, oh, the most basic Z-Brats formula, like, it's impossible for that to be a bad match. There's a baseline of really like 3.5 stars when Skywalker, Ishin, Minoru just do their thing. When they lay out a match to the ability that they can lay out a match, it doesn't matter who they're in the ring with. And, you know, those guys they were wrestling on that show happen to all be extremely young and extremely green. And I thought they had potential. I thought a lot of them looked okay. But that was a carry job with the most basic Z-Brats template possible. And it was a really, really enjoyable match as a result. So just the consistency that this unit was able to develop after escaping what was the first half of 2022, I think is really impressive.
Yeah, because we've seen units not be able to kind of peel out of that or spend their whole entire life, gold class, trying to get out of that situation and constantly find themselves getting pulled back into it. The fact that Z-Brats, I mean, by the time we were getting to 2023, and especially, I would argue by the time that Ishin turned at the back half of the year in 2022 and all of that kind of consolidating and gelling, really, I felt like got it to that point that it needed to be, that we got to have, I think, like 3 great years of a heel unit. And I wasn't necessarily like wanting to see Z-Brats go away necessarily, but the idea of a new heel unit in Madoka Kakuta's image and seeing what Gaja Dokuro has at least done on their first time as that unit has been fun to see so far.
I agree.
So let's talk about this Stormgate Corican show. So fittingly for the name, was right as a typhoon was about to skirt Tokyo on Thursday. So that also did not contribute. I felt like to vibes of a show that the crowd really, I felt like, brought it and kind of got you into some of the stuff throughout the show. But I don't think either the title matches were necessarily stellar, and I'm kind of like left. I had one of them at four. I had the Breakgate at four, but I kind of am left like more excited for the other show that's happening in Corican later this month, and then also the two matches they already have set up for the October Corican. I felt like it did a big job of treating this building as kind of the important building, as we knew that they kind of had to do, and then in doing so, case they kind of have a way that every championship but the Twin Gate will be defended in Corican over the next 2 months.
I will have my written review of this show up around the same time that this podcast goes up. They're both slated to go up on Tuesday, so I've got expansive thoughts on, in particular, the opening match and the Brave Gate match on this show. I thought the Brave Gate match was utterly remarkable, and I once again left just at a complete loss for words, and I eventually found them and wrote quite a bit about the match, but I was at a loss for words over what I saw from Jackie Kame, and that's a match that I ended up going 4.5 stars with, and I wrote in the review that this could have worked as an NWA welterweight title match in 2003. This could have worked as a Brave Gate match in 2013. Pick whatever your favorite era of Brave Gate matches. You know, if this happened during the Pac era, it would have fit right in, and then it fit right in here in 2025. It's just an utterly brilliant match. So to me, the Brave Gate match is absolutely essential viewing. I think for anybody voting in SFM 50 this year, Tanaka is somebody that I think should do incredibly well. I don't know if he's going to. And Kame, just on the high-end stuff that we've seen out of him, especially in the summer, you know, he is undoubtedly, to me, one of the 50 best wrestlers in the world. And this, to me, was sort of his capstone performance.
I ended up with four, as this was a match that the closing stretch, and especially right after it kind of kicked into the second or third gear, I thought that it ended up being really, really strong stuff. If it would have ended up being the same, it was a 15-minute match. If the first 7 minutes felt like the second half of the match, and it was that all throughout this, we would be talking about an all-timer. But I kind of, up until basically Tanaka doing the step up Tope Konholo over the turnbuckle, that up until that point, I kind of was like left with going like, all right, we see like the initial trades in and everything felt more like kind of just in a way didn't have what I was expecting going into the match. Like it felt in a way that Kamei and Tanaka, it took them like 3 minutes of wrestling to like develop, to like refine the chemistry that we've seen with them, because I don't know what it was for me for like that first 5 to 6 minutes, but up until the Tope Konholo, I was not into this match whatsoever.
I'm very surprised by that. I thought they hit it out of the park from the opening bell, and I was thoroughly invested in this throughout. With the finishing stretch, I mean, the cross saber counter into the Jackie knife was just the type of thing
that was incredible.
I can't believe everything. I wrote this in the review, but you know, Kame does the springboard poison rana, which he's never done before, and then you know, there they go into the Tormolino
ultra poison rana.
Yeah, that's right. Like, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then
that was insane.
To go into the Torbellino, and then for Tanaka to come back with a Spanish fly that then gets countered into the crucifix, and then Tanaka still on offense, Crimson Smash, Buzzsaw Kick, 2.5. Kame at that point counters that cross saber with a Jackie knife. Tanaka kicks out, cross saber, Stardust Press. He hits the Stardust Press perfectly. I mean, the back half of that match, that is on the level of anything that Yoshino ever did with Kness. That is on the level of anything that Yoshino ever did with Dragon Kid. That is on the level of anything that Pac ever did with Ricochet. That the final 7 minutes of this match were some of the best minutes of wrestling that I've watched in 2025. Now, the front half of the match, to me, worked. Again, this match worked from start to finish. It didn't necessarily have the drive that you would want to make this into a match of the year contender. But man, the back half of that match, I just thought was something really special.
I agree with you. The last 7 minutes, if this was the full match, I would have put it up there with Ricochet and Pac, but I just thought that it was just way too tentative. Actually kind of felt like the way, like, other than the dives that they were doing on each other, it just felt kind of tentative up until that over the top post Topic Hollow. But yeah, no, the closing minutes were just felt like it was just this was the thing. Is like, hey, we get to the closing stretch and we're going to do, I've never seen someone do a springboard ultra poison rana before, Kay.
Neither have I. It was done perfectly. You know, it looked dangerous, but Tanaka didn't die from it. That's everything you could want.
Yeah, and the Joker Strizer clean for once and for all. It can make the opening for Infinity now.
Yes, exactly. No, he nailed that. And I you know, we'll eventually go in order on this show, but I started talking about the Brave Gate match, so we might as well finish thoughts here. You know, I mean Kame's 0-5 in Brave Gate matches historically now. And to be clear, for all of my issues with the way that Love and Peace has been treated, I don't think that he should have won this match. I mean, this Tanaka reign is now feeling important and it's feeling vital. And I think part of that is that the Brave Gate belt has finally found its way back into Cork and Hall between Yamato versus Daiki and then UT versus Junior. And now with this Tanaka reign, having this very memorable, very defining match between Tanaka and Kame, the Brave Gate belt feels important right now. It feels like something that I'm looking forward to every single time I see a Brave Gate match announced. By the way, Tanaka versus Fuda included, because I really liked what they did with Fuda on this show, and I'm more in on Ryo Fuda than I have been since maybe 2022 at this point. But it was just a beautiful combination of things where these Kame title matches, again, this is, you know, my big complaint of the company right now is, why is this guy not just permanently a Twin Gate champion or a Triangle Gate champion? You know, you got to have a belt on this guy, because when he's in a big match, his hit rate is utterly astonishing. And then Tanaka, through three defenses, you know, between the really enjoyable UT match at World and then the Masuoka match at Buyuden, and then to go from Mochi, which I thought was slightly disappointing, to this brilliant Kame match, I'm fully invested in this Tanaka reign, and I hope that he has this belt for a really long time.
Yeah, Tanaka feels like the importance of where the Brave Gate was at during the early SB Kento days, and kind of like the last person that I know this is now, it feels kind of like ancient history, but the last like other Brave Gate champion that was feeling like, okay, this is someone that is on like a potentially historic path, was when Hyo was running through everyone and said, I think I need to face Daya right now. And then that run, of course, came to a screeching halt when he faced Daya. But it's a feeling of the belt that I feel like has been lost, at least for like the last year, that at least Tanaka, I mean, yeah, no, I look at my notes for it. And really, other than that Mochizuki match, you're talking about a guy who has not had anything lower than 4 stars for me so far as Brave Gate champion. And potentially, I mean, this might be the first solo 4-star Ryo Fudo match that I have for him coming up on Sunday. So yeah, it feels like this title has some life that it did not have basically going into Yamato and then really coming out of it. I as much as I love UT, this is a Brave Gate champion that we're seeing right now.
Well, I thought the UT reign was a perfect transitional reign, but you go back and look at the lineage of this Brave Gate belt, and after Daya loses it to Hyo, and this was at the Ultimo Dragon 35th anniversary show, so July of 2022, you know, that first Daya run was the Kento match where he won in 90 seconds, and the Fujiwara match that I sent to every promoter in the U.S. to try to see if they get Fujiwara on their show. You know, that's one of my favorite Brave Gate matches of all time. And then it's a Kento match at Dead or Alive, a Hyo double countout match in Hyo's hometown, and then Hyo won the belt from Daya at that show, that Ultimate Dragon 35th anniversary show. And from there, you go into this Hyo reign where it's, you know, a forgettable Kento match and a forgettable Jason match and a forgettable Dragon Kid match and a T-Lon Shisa match at get in Okinawa, which I don't think we ever saw. And then Minorita wins, and the Minorita reign didn't go the way that we thought it would. And then the Jason run was a bit of a bummer. And then it was, you know, Ishin, KZ, Ishin, Hyo. And again,
that last Hyo run, though, was the one that Hyo was killing everyone, and it felt like that it was going to be a thing. It was much longer than the other runs, too.
It's a weird reign to look at because it started a little rough. You know, there's a Kame match there that I'm not sure if that ever aired, but then, you know, Genki, Kagetora, Punch. I would normally also throw Kanda in there for the rough defenses, but that Kanda match is when things turned around. That was way better than it had any right to be. And then there was a Ho-Ho match in Hong Kong, that awesome Flamita match, and then Daya versus Hyo at World last year, which felt huge. And I feel like now we're on this run of, what is that, 16, 17 months, where the Bravegate belt has once again mattered, and it took Hyo, you know, really slumming it up that second time around with the Bravegate belt again, that, you know, that Genki Punch level of defense that just, that wasn't fun for anybody. But by the time we got to Hyo versus Daya, you look at the work that Daya did, and it's not like the Daya reign was all that incredible. You know, it was a Junta match and a Kame match, and then, you know, Tanaka and Yamato. Yamato gets the belt. He's got the one match with Daiki, knocks it out of the park. And then from there, you know, the Bravegate tournament to UT winning it to Tanaka winning it. There's life in the Bravegate division again, and it's a very nice thing. I just hope at some point we find it in ourselves to put this title on Jackie Kame for an extended period of time. God forbid.
At least if you do it now, his belt will match his ugly ring gear.
Well, let me. Jay had such a great post on his Blue Sky that I'm going to read verbatim here because Kame has just become one of my favorite wrestlers, maybe of all time. But, you know, Jay said any single one of these things, the ring gear, the entrance music, the hairline, would be enough to sink a regular wrestler. Kame overcomes all of it. He's incredible. And it's just, it is what it is. Like, the guy, you know, he's going to celebrate 6 years here in December. And part of what I wrote in my written review, again, you know, sorry to just, you know, continue to harp on this Bravegate match, but Kame's career exists almost entirely in a post-COVID universe, which means he exists entirely in a content consumption era universe. And I just feel like if Kame's career, if this stretch of his career happens from 2000 to 2005, or 2005 to 2010, or even 2010 to 2015, and we're dealing with a Kame comp DVD, or just the fact that, you know, yesterday wasn't old news and last month wasn't ancient history, I feel like we'd all think about this guy entirely different, because for years now, he's been on that level of one of the best wrestlers in the world, not named Ospreay or Danielson. He's not on that tier, but at his best, he's on the tier below them.
Yeah, and it's not just because I now permanently have it on my brain case, but, like, you lay it out very interestingly, because you take that case or the same profile as Kame and you bring it back another 15 years. We're talking about Masato Yakushiji, basically, almost like he even kind of looks like Yakushiji in a way. And it's like, yeah, no, like, because there are times like when I watch Yakushiji, I go like, this guy in 1999 might be the best wrestler in the world just in this match right now. But like, he never became more than just kind of a cult favorite. If he was in the mass consumption era, everyone would be like trying to find where Masato Yakushiji is right now. And I feel like that very much can be said about how you laid out with Kame going back in that time period too.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kame is a, you know, a better singles wrestler than Yakushiji ever was. Yeah. And I find his tag work and his trios work to be on the level, if not slightly better. He's a better version of Yakushiji. And we all know, you know, anybody in this bubble, anybody familiar with Masato Yakushiji's work, we all think about him to a certain degree. And that degree is an extremely high one. And I think Kame has a deeper resume, is a better wrestler, does everything better than Yakushiji, and I love that guy. So I don't know how else to sing his praises. It's going to be very disappointing for me with the year that he's had, and last year he was arguably even better. But when I go and look at my match the year tracking spreadsheet, and I have this Tanaka match in there at 4.5 stars, and then you just look at the high end stuff that Kame's been a part of this year, you know, the 8-man tag from the May Corkin show at 4.75, the Kobe World 3-way trios match that I also have at 4.75. You have the Rey de Pareja match, which was Kame and Rita versus Shun and Hamare from 3:30. You've got this match. And then, you know, you want to factor in the Kobe World match that completely died a death after Kame was eliminated from the match. You know, or Flamita and Monte versus Kame and Rita, you know, Ben, Jack Jr. and Rita versus Hamare, Jason, Minoru, and Skywalker from the beginning of the year. There's just all this stuff that you can dig into, and you just go, obviously, this is not only one of the 50 best wrestlers in the world, this is a guy who is one of the 25 best wrestlers in the world. And I think that thought is so foreign to so many people, and I don't know how to change that thought, but to me, this is a guy who just continues to be on a tear. And the special thing with Kame, and you've said this and I've said this for years now, is that the bigger the opportunity, the better that he gets. And not every wrestler is like that, but this guy is just something different. And I have just completely fallen in love with him and his career. And I am so excited whenever he gets a spot like this.
Yeah, there's just a part of me that's hoping that some kid in 2045 is going to go through whatever wasteland of world we have and like taps into the internet and whatever wrestling that's existed by TKO and the Blood Dome and what have you, they end up watching Jackie Kamei stuff. They're like, you know what? I want to be like this Jackie Kamei guy. I feel like that's going to be one of those things about him that like, we're going to like, like you look at him now coming up on that near 6 year anniversary and everything. And really looking at like pure athleticism and like ring work wise, like maybe like when you compare him to Ospreay right now, yes, there was that clear level, but I wonder how much, like, if you compare like the first 6 years of people's careers, how Kamei kind of stands up in that level. Because I feel like at least and some of this is that we've now, I mean, would you say we've probably seen 300 Kamei matches at this point?
Well, let me see how many total matches he has, because I have a hard time just guesstimating based on the raw number. But Kamei, throughout his entire career, has, let me go to his cage match. He's got 7 pages. He's got 694 matches listed on cage match. Yeah, we've probably seen 300 of those.
Yeah. I was just doing like scratch match. I wonder how he would compare in those like 300 matches to like the first 300 matches of Will Ospreay's MMA tape, you know, like just as like a point of comparison. Like, I think we probably would end up coming to the same conclusion about Ospreay v Kamei, but I wonder if we frame the discussion that way, we kind of maybe there is a little bit of a different appreciation for how Kamei has been, because I feel like in some ways he's locked on to it a lot faster than some of these greats did in a lot of ways.
My first Kamei match at 4 stars or higher was August 15th, 2020. And so that's after him debuting in December, wrestling January, February, March on a limited schedule. And then COVID, which largely took Dragon Gate out of commission until July 4th of that year. So yeah, you're talking about a guy who I've got a 4.25-star match at, you know, in totality, 5 or 6 months into his career. And that, just for the sake of reference, was, I'll read these names as I have them listed: Don Fuji, Naruki Doi, Shuji Kondo, and Susumu Yokosuka versus Kento Kabune, Madoka Kakuta, Sora Fujikawa, and Taketo Kame. That was August 15th, 2020. And throughout that year, you know, he plays a really vital part down the stretch in the generational warfare, because Kento turns on him and then Kakuta turns on him, and you end up with that Korakuen main event. I remember this so vividly. I was so into this when it happened. You end up with this Korakuen main event that was Eita, Hyo, Kaito Ishida, Madoka Kakuta, and SB Kento versus Dragon Kid, Masato Yoshino, Naruki Doi, Shuji Kondo, and Taketo Kame. And that was when we were like, oh my God, is Kame something? Like, this is a guy. This is absolutely a guy. He was so entertaining in that match. And that was right when Kakuta turned. That is right after Ishin turned. That is when Kento had been heel for, I think, a month at that point. And Kame was there as the lone babyface of his generation. And he stepped up to the plate, Korakuen Hall main event, knocked out of the park. And that has become what his career has become, is the bigger the scenario, the better that he is. And that is a very, very special trait to have.
Yeah, he is a really special wrestler. Should we talk about the main event before we get into the rest of the card? Just kind of, since we're already kind of delving into the big spots, talk about Dragon Gate's first ever title ladder match that they had at the show and everything coming out of that.
Yeah, let's do it.
So it was the first time that a title match has happened under ladder match rules. Gigi Horiguchi, Jack Evans, and Akira Tozawa did one in 2006 that Jay very appropriately described as, well, everyone got hurt. So that was enough for Dragon Gate not to do that for almost 20 years. But instead, Team Mexico, Flamita, Luis Monte, and Bandido versus Gaja Dokuro's Kai Ishin and Yoshiki Kato. The finish ends up being Ishin mists Flamita on top of the one ladder that actually can reach the belt. And that sends Ishin, or that sends Flamita down to the mat after a really gross sequence with them before, with a power bomb that looked absolutely gnarly onto a ladder. Ishin gets the belt off of the tape and down here. He celebrates with black mist covering his body completely. Gaja Dokuro celebrates, then Shun storms out. He wants a 2-on-3 for the triangle gate. GM Saito says, well, it's a trio's belt, so no, you can't do that. Shun says he starts calling out Young Boy, and he says, oh yeah, no, I mean Kimura, get up here, you're teaming with us next month. And that's how we close out the Cork. And it's after a ladder match that had its moments. I felt like we got the full Bandido experience. All in all, I thought that it ended up being gnarly and what you would hope for, but I felt like this crowd was really up for it in a way that I felt like that sometimes the crowd mix, it's noticeable if you go commentary or not, or Japanese commentary versus English commentary. The crowd in a promotion that sometimes the fans can be tentative about things like this, completely up for it. And I felt like that added a lot to a pretty fun ladder match that I felt like you got the best of Bandido, and you also got a power bomb that went really bad.
Not anything that I need to see again from this promotion. I feel like this is probably one that should be a one and done. But for what it was, you know, a promotion that doesn't typically do car crash matches, I thought it was a fine display of car crash wrestling that also felt true to Dragon Gate with the I was going to say Z-Brats running. Let me see. I haven't pronounced the heel unit on this show yet. Let me see if I can give this a shot. You had the run-in.
You almost made an hour without doing this, by the way. So good work dodging it for a whole hour.
I'm going to continue to do it. Shame on Dragon Gate for not thinking about the white podcasters when they named this new heel unit. I felt my stomach hurt when I read it for the first time. I was like, oh, God, this is going to be so much harder to say.
Just rest assured that your first time saying it, no matter what, will be a million times better than what Joe's first response probably was in his brain when he saw it.
Oh, well, yeah, Lance is never watching Dragon Gate again. This is going to be too big of a hang-up for him. But the the Gaja Dokuro run-in, I thought felt true to form. The vibe same after that. I really liked that they had the core Dragon Gate spot in a match like this. You know, I thought it was very good. It never touched great for me. I didn't feel like I was watching a great match at any point. But the high spots that were there, you know, you mentioned the Flamita sunset flip on the ladder, which Jade was saying was maybe supposed to be a destroyer, and that Flamita slipped, which is absolutely terrifying. But that spot, and then to me, the spot of the match, the Bandito step up swanton bomb to the floor, that stuff delivered. That stuff was super cool.
That was wild. You know,
and it's a bummer that the table didn't break, because I think just human instinct is to almost discount that spot, but go back and watch it.
No, it's wild.
He gets so high in the air, is jumping at a weird angle, and then, you know, he lands on Kato. He just doesn't break the table. That spot to me was absolutely insane.
No, like Bandido, I mean, he also does a stereo plancha with Monte off of the stairways, clearing the stairwell. I mean, like the things that Bandido is able to do as a guy of his size, like the amount of flying that he's able to do is like truly remarkable. And it you kind of have to accept that sometimes it comes with like a top row power bomb that he does not go up, and then they have to kind of do it again, and then it's able to go, because you get stuff like that dive that I actually like the fact case that table didn't break, because that was clearly a table that they have had for the last 11 years, because you could tell, because it still uses some of the old Dragon Gate logo fabric, and that's kind of a fun game to play when you see things like that. You'll see a wild RED logo sometimes on house shows, I've noticed. But I thought that his performance, like, you, I do thoroughly think you got the full experience with him. And in this kind of context and doing it more like a car crash kind of match versus a 2 out of 3 falls match with Super Crazy ends up being a lot better of a performance.
Yeah. Again, I at no point felt like I was watching a bad match, but I don't need this again. You know, it's not, maybe this is a closed-minded thought process to have, but this is not why I come here. You know, this is not what I need from this promotion. Was there inherent novelty in Ishin doing the Terry Funk ladder spot? Of course there was. Was there novelty in seeing Flamita just be a complete crazy person? You know, the other crazy spot of this match, which didn't involve a ladder, but Jay, Ho-Ho, and myself were all equally impressed by this, was Flamita and Monte doing the stereo springboard Hurricanranas, which could have gone so wrong, and yet they nailed that spot doing the double springboard at the same time on the same rope. Completely insane.
Oh my God. JJ's commentary about talking about balance on that was like, I did not think about that until he brought that up. And then I was like, oh yeah, you know, yeah, holy shit. I didn't think about like that. That's why you need to have a skateboarder in the booth. They understand things like that.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, I thought Jay was marvelous on this show. I thought he was so good in every match, whether it was, you know, Kimura Jr. laying at the background there, you know, adding comedy to the Takashi match and the two title matches where he was just completely in his bag. I mean, Jay, I think he's become, you know, maybe the best play-by-play guy in wrestling, which I know doesn't compute in his brain, but it really is true. But yeah, you know, it was a novel match. It is certainly one that I will remember. As I talked about last week, you know, being able for a number of years to be able to tell you every month's Cork and Hall main event. And at some point, I consumed too much, and now I don't have that power. I'll remember this ladder match. You know, this is one that's going to stick in my mind, even if I didn't particularly like the match. I'm glad they did it once. I don't really need to see it again.
Yeah, I also, now they do 17 Corkins a year instead of 13. Like, and those 4 cloud things up, I feel like.
Yeah, I would agree with that, yes.
Do you want to talk about Benkei or do you want to talk about Kimura?
Well, I do want to, yeah, let's talk about Kimura. Then we'll combine the main event angle with the opening match and we'll go back up the card from there. My favorite angle in all of wrestling right now is veteran wrestler calls Kazuma Kimura into the ring because I never know what is going to happen when that happens.
Yeah, I don't know if he really knows what happened. So Kazuma Kimura in his 1 month of Dragon Gate Pro Wrestling has already made an indelible impact. And that continued with what I thought was one of the better matches on the show. Like after the 2 title matches, this was the one I ended up with going 3.5 stars on. Mochizuki Jr. versus Kazuma Kimura. Mochizuki Jr. ends up winning with the German suplex hold. And just like this match where it's laid out like strikes versus submission, but instead you get to see just 2 young guys chop the piss out of each other. Kazuma Kimura going for the cross arm breaker in every way possible. And I wrote this down on Friday when I watched the showcase. I don't know how much it's not jogging my mind here. Did either him or Junior do a Cobra Clutch hip toss during this match? Because someone did a Cobra Clutch hip toss that I want to end up being like a secondary like finisher for one of these guys that looked gnarly.
I don't believe so, but
I think it's Junior. I think Junior did that.
Okay, I sure said, yeah, it was. Okay, I got you now. Yeah, it was. It was Junior. I see it in my notes right here. But yeah, what a match. I mean, the thing with Kimura. And this, I hope this doesn't sound like overly dramatic praise that a certain sect of wrestling reviewers might use, but it is 100% true that the most interesting part of Kimura's matches right now are when he's on the ground, and that is something that I've never felt about, you know, a Maestro Luchador match, or, you know, God forbid, a boring Tim Thatcher match. Kimura working on the mat is nothing but high spots in my mind, and seeing, and I put this on my Twitter, but, you know, having him counter a German suplex by rolling through into a Fujiwara armbar, and then for him to turn that Fujiwara armbar into the cross arm breaker, utterly phenomenal stuff. I am so, so into that, and I hope that as his career progresses, you know, this is something that Joe Lanza talks about a lot is, you know, he enjoys that style of the basic Japanese young boy wrestling style so much, and he kind of wants a promotion that's just that. And I'm with him. You know, I would be very into that. With Kimura, I hope that the more he gets elevated, he doesn't lose his tenacity on the mat, because I really think that's what makes him an interesting wrestler.
Yeah, because like when we've seen wrestlers with this kind of profile, maybe not like this decorated, but when you think about like other judoka in this promotion, really you go to Lindemann and you go to, if you remember him, Shoya Sato. But the thing is with them, Sato, his whole entire offense was kind of based around it, which was kind of the novelty, but we didn't get to see him progress much further. Whereas with Lindemann, other than still doing a judo throw as like a rebound spot occasionally in a big match, he's kind of dropped that. Like, he still grapples, but it's like a different style thing. You can see now, especially the more he goes along, he's more interested with more of a shoot style than he is with like Dragon System work, I would say. But Kimura being able to keep it and being able to have that always be like his bedrock for it, especially get someone like Mochizuki Jr., who might be one of the most flexible people on the roster, so you're able to kind of wrench him a little bit more. I know that this was just an opener, 10-minute opener, a good bit of fun all throughout, but it just like, I want them to go back to this. I want to throw UT into the mix with Kimura. I want to see Kimura versus Yave style. I kind of just want to do mixed styles matches with Kazuma Kimura and the rest of the roster. Like, how does Kazuma Kimura take on Don Fuji? Like, if Don Fuji coming in there, UWA Trios champ, like, how do you do that? Because I'm intrigued to find out.
I feel like there's a barn burner with he and UT around the corner at some point here pretty soon.
Yeah, I'm just hoping that it ends up in this building and it's not somewhere like in Ichinoseki, you know?
Yeah.
I mean with that. But afterwards, after the match, Yamato comes out. Yamato's been very impressed with Kimura's lack of chill, being able to step up into everyone's face, and in general, just not kind of being like a twerp, I feel like is the thing about Kimura that I think draws to Yamato. So Yamato invited him into Paradox, thinking, hey, you can be that Paradox assistant that we were clamoring for. And Kimura says, you know what? I don't think so. I don't think I'm ready for that yet. And Yamato says, oh, well, don't die and I'll talk to you later. I'm not good. Because you know how Yamato's like, he's going to keep on asking him until he says yes. Well, interestingly enough, as we talked about that main event with Shun Skywalker coming out afterwards with Hamare, Kimura was more than willing to jump up and get into the match for that's happening at the October Korakuen. So maybe we get someone else who has been under the thrall of Shun Skywalker and throws off the yoke of the Dragon System to go for Psypatra powers or whatever.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, I would be very into that.
But I just like Yamato kind of as a figure in Kimura. Like, I feel like that this should be something that one way or another, Yamato never lets die in his mind. And now it's like, hey, I looked out for you when you first tried out, and now you associate with Shun. And then that I feel like after that series with UT, why not have a 5-minute exhibition match with Yamato? I feel like Yamato might have some frustrations to get out on the guy.
Well, and I think it, you know, the longer that Kimura resists Yamato, I think it sets up a pretty interesting thing for Skywalker to do away from the heel unit, where now you can do Skywalker, Hamare, and Kimura against, you know, Yamato Dren Kid Kage, Yamato Bibi Hokage, Yamato Dren Kid Doi. And I think the Paradox versus Shun's Army Trios matches could be pretty interesting.
Yeah, and it solves the big problem with Shun being essentially a lone wolf, where we've seen so many times what happens when you only really have one guy and you're a lone wolf in Dragon Gate. It becomes very hard to be a relevant presence. Kimura answers that question perfectly, if you ask me. Like, just now you're able to do a whole lot more of Shun and Hamare on the shows. You can do Hamare teaming with Shun, and then you can do a Kimura and an undercard, or you can do Shun and Kimura and Hamare in a singles match, but you get to have more of a presence there that has been an issue in the past with these kinds of splits.
Yeah, absolutely.
So continuing down the card, after the opener, we had Natural Vibes versus unaffiliated, Strong Machine J, KZ, and UT versus Don Fuji, Takashi, and Ryu Fuda. Monde Ryu. And Takashi gets the win with a really dominating kind of stretch against UT, including a huge pineapple bomber. This one was a little bit of a shenanigans fest, guys.
We can move on.
Yep. Then we had Mochizuki Dojo, Masaki Mochizuki, Ryu Fuda, Akihiro Sahara, and Daiki Yanagiuchi versus Paradox, Yamato, Susumu, Hulk, and Kagetora. This one was a whole bunch of getting after it. Akihiro Sahara, after an exchange of Yamato, was visibly bleeding from the chest. But it was Ryu Fuda, the resurgent Ryu Fuda, hitting the Kiryu driver on Kage, getting the win. He came out after the Brave Gate match to set up the destined Gate of Origin Brave Gate match. In case, I know you claim to have sold all the stock. Now, did you have buried in your yard or in a shoebox just like one share of Ryu Fuda Incorporated for moments like this?
I had the cash stuffed in the bird feeder and the bird seed like Tony Soprano did. That was my move. I guess that was Carmella's move technically. So yeah, I was holding on to 1% waiting for this. You know, Mike, what is my complaint about Ryu Fuda been for, you know, the last 3 years, is that I don't trust this guy to have a good match when he's not in the ring and more often than not directly opposed from a member of the Mochizuki family. I've seen him have good matches with Masaki Mochizuki. That's not hard. Masaki Mochizuki could kick me to 3.25 stars. I've seen him have good matches with Mochizuki Jr., but that's Mochizuki Jr. Again, we're not far off from what I just said about Masaki Mochizuki. Seeing him and Kagetora here in the finishing stretch of this match, I had to throw my hands up and go, all right. You know, this is not one of those Grand Theft Auto memes of, oh shit, here we go again. I'm not on the Ryu Fuda train and I'm never going to be fully back on the train, but that might have been his best performance since his debut match against Masaki Mochizuki in 2021 at Gate of Origin.
Yeah, no, I do kind of wonder, like, what do you do with him after this match? Because, like, this is, like, the one thing that's been, like, dangling out of his grasp for the last 2 years. And that alone should, like, bear anyone. It should, like, fear themselves of having any shares of Ryu Fuda stock after this Sunday. Because what do you do after this?
But it all depends on how the match with Tanaka goes. If he goes out there and has the same level of effort and the same level of performance that he had in this match, in the title match, okay, all right, then let's continue. Let's see where he goes from here. You know, if that's a 4.25 star Brave Gate match that we're talking about next week, I'm going to want to see more of that. I'm going to want to see him win matches. I'm ready for Fuda and Yanagiuchi and Sahara to all start winning. I really think Mochizuki Dojo is starting to overstay their welcome if they're going to continue losing. I want all three of those guys to be able to pick up wins here and there. And if Fuda is great next weekend, then good. I think the solution is just to have him do more of that. The problem is that if it's not a 4.25 star match, it's a 3.25 star match. And it's, you know, the biggest bummer of Tanaka's reign, then I think we can go, okay, all right, we're, you know, Akihiro Sahara, you're up. Daiki Yanagiuchi, let's get you some wins. Ryu Fuda, we're done with you. You're going to be match two for the rest of your career.
You know what I noticed? Two things on this match. First off, this did feel like the most effort out of the dojo since, like, their disbands match against Z-Brats in January. Mm-hmm. Like, this felt like the most vibrant and most, like, okay, this is what we wanted Mochizuki Dojo to be in the first place, right? Like, everyone felt like they had a little bit more pep. There was a little bit more of, like, the feisty youngster kind of thing about it. And I felt like that added this here when that just has not been the case with this not unit for the last 5 months, basically. I feel like this singly was like, oh yeah, this is why this unit can be a lot of fun with show with you here. A second thing, Case, during introductions, did notice something very potentially interesting and something that I think that you brought him up here. And yes, Akihiro Sahara is only 87 kilos.
Okay.
He can that's only 11 pounds. We could be talking about Tanaka versus Sahara.
I feel like they're specifically positioning Sahara in a way that he doesn't do that. I think they're trying to lean into his size, but, you know, I'm not going to complain if they make that match. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. That was something, because I was thinking about the size thing, too. I was like, no, I mean, American football player, hot-blooded touchdown. Come on. Like, I was expecting to see him push in a little higher. Guys on this roster right now are a lot lighter than I feel like they have been built in the past. Like Benkei, under 100 kilos by good factor right now. Like Kakuta and Takashi are probably the two heaviest people on the roster right now, you know? Like, and it felt like for a while there was such like a clear cliff to Brave Gate weight, but Sahara being 87 kilos made me reassess that a little bit.
Yeah, I had not thought about that. That's a good point.
Yeah, because I remember there were times like Ben was like jumping at like 115 kilos. And right now, Ben is listed on the site as 100 kilos. He was listed as, I think, 90 kilos on the Chiron at Corkin.
Interesting. So, well, let's talk about Benkei. Am I one match ahead or did I time that correctly?
One match ahead. We had the three-way... Damn. The 2025 tag team match, really. Like, if you're talking about, if you had this be a four-way match and Minnow Lee was in here, case you'd be talking about like the four tag teams that should be on the tip of your lips when you think about Dragon Gate tag teams, as it was D-Courage, Yuki Yoshioka, and Dragon Daya versus Paradox, Naruki Doi, and Dragon Kid, that's not Hug, versus Shun Skywalker and Hamare. It was one of them, but now, like, even me not really being on social media anymore, case I saw it going around, one of the more moves of this show, it was Shun Mari winning with the psychic ray, which is the Asai DDT aided Shirinu, wild thing done by Hamare onto Daya to win. This match was a whole lot of fun. Didn't get to that gear you would think out of, you would hope out of these three. But I think when you have a match put right here on a show that you knew that the last two matches were going to be kind of where the fireworks were going off, having like this version of this match, I thought was perfectly fun and I had a good time with it.
I would mark it as slightly disappointing with the caveat that Shun and Hamari as a tag team are terribly, terribly exciting. And that follows the trend of Skywalker's career. When you look at the few mainstay tag team partners that he had, I really think he's only had two, or, you know, two and a half if you want to count Benkei. But you think about the resume that he had with Masaki Mochizuki, you think about the resume that he had with Diamante. And then again, you know, there are some Benkei matches in there that are really enjoyable, but spoiler alert, Shun Skywalker is good at another thing. He's a very, very good tag team wrestler, and this tag team with Hamari just has so much life. I'm really enjoying watching these guys get after it.
Yeah, and it was kind of interesting of a match where it very quickly ended up being just D-Courage versus Not Hug, and they were kind of out on the outside. But then Shun Mari was able to start getting Not Hug, identifying their weakness, which is that they're never really on the same page. And they were able to kind of completely get them off their game. There was a moment of a really delayed doible attempt that Shun Mari quickly were able to kind of get this, even to an extent where you had the hug, not hug spot into a super kick. And really, this is for a team that, like, this is a 9-minute match, and Shun Mari sat out of the middle 4 minutes of, and I still... that they were able to leave the mark on the match in the way that you're right. Like, we get to see a lot now of Shun Mari because that's who Shun has the team. But this is kind of a match where you're like, if this was like the main event, this would get another 8 minutes, and this would be easily a 4.25 start match to start with, right? Like, but it's just with the card format and what was presented to us, I feel like for match four pre-intermission, this might have been the ceiling, but it's just a shame that we didn't get that 4.5-star main event version of it.
I would agree with that.
And then we get to Ben as we'll talk more about everything else than the match itself, as it was Ben, Hyo, and Rita versus Madoka Kakuta and Minnow Lee of Gajah Dokuro. And it was Ben with a spear on Kota Minora and 3 minutes after no selling a chair shot. The only thing it did was like send him into like his finishing stretch mode. He immediately takes out Minoru, wins it very quickly, and challenges Madoka Kakuta for the August Cork and for the Dreamgate title.
This match represented something in wrestling that I really think is missing everywhere. I think every promotion could learn from a match like this, Dreamgate included. I mean, they're as guilty of it as anybody. It is so important to have these matches that are rhythm breakers, that just stand out from the pack. Something happens in this specific slot on the card that you're not ready for. And the last thing that I was expecting was for Benkei to shake off a chair shot, spear Coach Minoru, hit a pair of lariats, and then spear Coach Minoru again en route to a 3-minute victory. And all of a sudden, you know, it's not rocket science. Benkei looked absolutely incredible. He looks like a guy that's ready to challenge for the Dreamgate belt. And I just wish that more promotions would do this exactly. You know, this is the blueprint to follow. This is what I want out of every promotion. And I want it to happen in semi-main events and main events and title matches. But man, I just love what this match represented.
And it's also like the fact that like you did this in a way where Ben doesn't even like really touch hands with Kakuta at all during this match. I think it was just the chair shot was the only thing that happens. And it's convincing enough. And you have someone who already has the credibility to kind of be put in that position. And you look at a show, and especially how Dragon Gate does these Cork and Hall shows. Usually it's 6 matches this week. It's been more 7 matches recently. And they usually like after the main event and the opener, the match that ends up like being like, if you kind of plot it out, either being not necessarily like the work rate match, but it can't be that way. But one of the things on the show, like if you were going to treat this like the quarter hours of a Dynamite or Raw, match 4 or match 5, the go-to intermission match ends up, if it's not a work rate thing case, it ends up being like something notable and something that you go like, oh yeah, no, Ben tore through and had a Dreamgate challenge, and everyone was like, hell yeah, because he just tore a hole through everyone, and Kota Minoru just ate it, and it made a whole lot of sense. And I think it's also just like smart, as I like laid out there, smart realization of your card layout and being able to use it for your benefit here, because how many times would you just have like a match happen and just go to intermission? So many times. Dragon Gate, I feel like when it's really turning on, they put some emphasis on that match 4 or match 5 in this case, and that's what we got to see here.
So that leaves us, you know, next month at Cork, and with not only the Dreamgate match between Benkei and Madoka Kakuta, but also the Triangle Gate match, as you mentioned earlier, Kato Kai and Ishin versus Kazuma Kimura, Himare, and Shun Skywalker. I think it's worth noting on this, you know, one of the, I don't know if critique is the right word, but one of the points I've made as Noah continues to draw incredibly well in Cork and Hall is that, you know, they've loaded up their shows with multiple title matches on each show, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think typically the standard Dragon Gate Cork and show looks a little bit different than the standard pro wrestling Noah Cork and show. We are now hitting this point in the calendar year where we're in the great unknown. You know, we don't have Gate of Destiny coming up in Osaka #1 in November the same way that we do. And so what you're seeing is a bit of a pattern break in terms of what we would get in the Dragon Gate fall calendar as well. And I like that we're going to head into a Corgan here with 2 title matches. To me, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and I, as we kind of became aware of this, like the thing that it's worth keeping in your mind and is that essentially this is the biggest building for Dragon Gate up until they're running Fukuoka in February. We still don't have a Yokohama date for January, don't we?
No, we do not. No, we do not. You're right.
So, I mean, but Dragon Gate's shifting to have that focus that Pro Wrestling Noah has in the building. Like, it's not having the immediate payoff. I still think that if you're really doing show to show, you're going to have to pay an asterisk because of the typhoon that skirted Tokyo a couple hours after this. But it does feel like that if this becomes that building that you're going to have that importance on, these are the things you want to see. And I mean, you have Gate of Miyane coming up before that, and that show is like a full court press on trying to get things that will not necessarily get the average Dragon Gate viewer there. So it's really interesting to see for a company that so long has been like, hey, yeah, we run a show in Tokyo every month, but it's not our most important show of the month. Now we're at this time where it's like, yes, it very much is the most important show of the month. How important is it? Well, the only title match that we have not had out of our major titles to happen in this building over the course of 6 weeks will be the tag titles. Like, it's interesting to see. And I would like to see on this August 8th Cork and to see, like, with this kind of... with this kind of booking, to start seeing some returns from it, because I don't think you could say that there's another way they should be handling it other than how they have. Like, this is what I would do in this scenario too.
No, it continues to be a promotion that I think is really well booked and really exciting, and we're just not seeing the return to the box office. It'll be curious to see what we get this Sunday. Mike, do you want to run down the Gate of Origin card? Do you want me to do it before we get out of here?
I got it right here. Gotcha. When we're talking about box office case, they're finally cashing in the Ryo Fuda and Sendai chip here weekend in the Miyagi-san Fest in Sendai City. It is the Gate of Origin. It's kind of the C-tier show that they have every year up in the Tohoku region. Running through the card, we open with Paradox, Dragon Kid, Susumu Yokosuka, and Kakutora versus Natural Vibes, Strong Machine J, KZ, and Flamita. Match two, we have Mochizuki Dojo, Masaki Mochizuki, Daiki Yanaguchi, Akihiro Sahara versus unaffiliated Luis Monte, Mondai Ryu, and Kazuma Kimura. Doesn't get to team with Shun Skywalker on this show because Shun Skywalker is going up against Kota Minora in a special singles match. Our pre-intermission match will be Yamato from neighboring Ichinoseki. That's where they were earlier this week, Case. They were in Yamato's hometown. Teaming with BB Hulk against D-Courage, Yuki Yoshioka, and Dragon Daya. Semi-main event, open the Brave Gate, Championship Ryoya Tanaka versus Ryo Fuda. In the main event, Case, I told you this right before we went on air, and I've been staring at this match in this tab for the last hour and a half. Whenever I tab over to it, it's the match I see, and there's not a match in wrestling right now I'm more excited than this, and you could archer psychiatrist me any sort of way with that. Love and Peace versus Gaja Dokuro, Captain's Fall Elimination Match. Benkei, Hyo, Jackie Kamei, Rita, and Mochizuki Jr. versus Madoka Kakuta, Jason Lee, Kai Ishin, and Yoshiki Kato. Your captains for Love and Peace is Ben, and your captain for Gaja Dokuro is Madoka Kakuta. Case, they just like drop like one of my favorite match types on us, and it's easily like I want the, like, this is like a match I feel like they should be touring the country with. I can't wait for it.
You know, credit to them. I found Gate of Origin over the last 2 years to be a pretty hard watch, and those cards to be pretty lifeless, but I like everything on this show. I'm very excited for the Brave Gate match, whatever that might be. I love the Captain's Fall stuff. I think Shun versus Minoru is fascinating on a number of levels, and I'm really interested to see Kimura go against the Mochizuki Dojo guys. So a credit to Dragon Gate. I think this should be a really fun show. I wasn't looking forward to this on paper before we got the card. Now I'm very excited for this show.
The only interesting absence is Hamare. I wonder if he's doing a promo tour or if he's going to show up and be involved in that match three in some type.
I would assume it's that, but we'll have to wait and see.
We'll have to wait and see, and we'll be back next week to talk to you about a Gate of Origin at our normal recording time. Thanks for everyone bearing with us as we're a little early this week. Case, is there anything else you want to touch on before we're out of here?
No, I got nothing else.
Well, you can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. You can find Case at _inyourcase on Twitter. I'm at Fuchiheya. You could join the Voices of Wrestling Discord to talk more about Dragon Gate. There's the great Dragon Gate channel where there's matches of the week. The link posts to the Texas Wrestling Cartel match that Case was talking about earlier, and just general Gaja Dokuro just discussion after the match and the reveal there. Also, forgot that Tomoaki Hanma showed up in Dragon Gate over this weekend. But those are the kind of things that are talked about in the Dragon Gate channel, as well as Open the Voice Gate channel. That's where we post our show, our match links for the shows, as well as a pin post with all of our evergreen historical shows there. And you can find that on the Voices of Wrestling Discord. That's going to do it for this week. We'll be back with you next time talking about Gate of Origin. Have a good week, everyone. Take care. Bye.
Hi, I'm Case Lowe, co-host of the Open the Voice Gate podcast. The one question I'm constantly asked when it comes to Dragon Gate is how do I get into the promotion? Well, stop asking and start listening to the Open the Voice Gate podcast, released every Wednesday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. For exclusive news and show reviews, look no further than the leader in Dragon Gate coverage, Open the Voice Gate.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.